And I'd like you all to join me in welcoming our speaker, Matt B. from Falls Church.
My name is Matt Berkowitz. I'm an alcoholic. And start off, I have a sobriety date. It's November 1st, 1998. I'm actively sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a grateful member of a home group. And for those three things, I am truly grateful. And if I don't say anything else, it's that those things are really the most important things in my life today. Keeping true to that sobriety date, doing what I need to do to stick with that sobriety date, and participating in my home group and being accountable to the sponsor. And I want to thank Billy for inviting me back down here. And it is an honor and a privilege to participate in my sobriety. It really is. And we're talking about how he mentioned it was a little bit of a light turnout and it's football season, you know. Some people have different priorities than we have. And I don't judge them. I do. But, you know, my favorite team that's not the Redskins is playing, but there's no place I'd rather be than a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you. And I hope that maybe you don't want to be here now and that you'd rather be watching the football game or doing something else, but you get to a place where there's nothing no place you'd rather be than to be among friends and family in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just feel the warmth and the love and to feel the presence of your higher power. And that's where I found my higher power is the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, if you're new, I hope you get a copy of the big book and a sponsor. There is a lot of stuff that goes on for all the meetings that we have in the D.C. area. There's 2,000 meetings, and some are better than others. What the big book has done for me is really what it'll do for you is it'll protect you from people like me who have opinions. And, you know, as far as I understand it, alcoholism has gone back all the way back to the Bible, to Noah, you know. Noah's in recorded history, our first alcoholic gets off the ark and crushes the grape. And in all of history of alcoholism, you know, AA has really been the only thing that has kept a drunk like me sober for this period of time. And not just sober, but happy. And who am I to play with this? Who am I to start thinking that I know something better Bill couldn't have written this book at 3.5 years sober. You know, I believe it's divinely inspired. So who am I to start thinking I can improve upon this? And I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years, hearing all kinds of things. Just don't drink and go to meetings was my favorite. Well, if I could just not drink, why do I need your stupid meetings? You know? Hear things like, well, just play the tape through. Now it's like CD player. But, well, if I could just play the tape through and think the drink through, I wouldn't need to be here either because the book says the problem centers in my mind. I start thinking long enough, and I start thinking like a drink sounds like a really good idea. You know, another one was my disease is doing push-ups in the parking lot, which confused the heck out of me because I was in meetings where there was no parking lot. And I was just burnt out when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would hear other things like, whoever got up earliest this morning has been sober the longest. Okay, so you've been up 7 days straight. You want to sponsor me? And during this time, I was just very confused because I would hear things. And I didn't know what was real. I didn't know what wasn't. I didn't know what I had. I didn't know I suffered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I didn't understand that I suffered from a spiritual malady. I thought that people just misunderstood me and mistreated me. And because of the way you were, I needed to drink to feel okay. And when you take away alcohol from me, I start feeling bad. And I start feeling homicidal and suicidal. And that's not really what I was hearing in meetings. I was just hearing, I stopped drinking, and my life is wonderful. And I'm not saying that's what was said in the meetings, but that's what I heard. And I would sit there, and among the other stuff, suffice to say, I never got a sponsor, and I never looked in the book, so I've got to take responsibility for myself. And I wasn't done drinking. But the bottom line was I wasn't hearing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's been presented to me in this sobriety. that I do suffer from a spiritual malady, that I have a mental obsession, and I have this physical allergy. I just didn't understand what was wrong with me. I couldn't be an alcoholic because alcohol was the only thing that was making me feel normal. I thought an alcoholic was just somebody who basically had to drink, and they were just a miserable person to begin with, and were always going to be a miserable person, and they lived in a cardboard box and drank out of paper bag. And I never lived in a cardboard box, you know, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. And I'd come up with all these different reasons why I was not an alcoholic. And, you know, my first drink, I grew up in the Jewish religion, and they have a little ceremony called a snipping clip or circumcision, and they give the baby wine to dull the pain. And that was my first drink, and I don't remember it. I guess that would be my first blackout. And it was my first resentment. And I am a blackout drinker, and I am someone who picks up resentments very easily. And it's because I have a lack of faith in God, and I want to control things, and I'm selfish, and I'm self-centered, and I expect people to behave a certain way, and when they don't behave a certain way, I get resentful. And I get resentful long enough, and then I get restless, I get irritable, I get discontented, and I have no choice but to take a drink again to make myself feel just a little bit comfortable. And my earliest memories of a kid, you know, before my first drunk was feeling this restless irritability and discontentedness. And the first time I read that in the doctor's opinion, I said, my God, that's me. How did they know? And this is, mind you, I had had a big book in my apartment for 5 years prior to the time I ever opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and found that. Maybe 6 years. And I just remember as this kid in kindergarten and nursery school, I got kicked out of nursery school and I stayed back in kindergarten because I couldn't play well with the other kids. And I just remember feeling like I didn't fit in. I felt like something was wrong. I felt like there was, all these other kids got a rule book. They've got a book and they're how to behave and how, you know, I'm in kindergarten for the second time. I should know where the toys are, but I feel like the kids know where the good toys are before I do. Like they just know what's up. It felt like the teacher told them all to wear red and forgot to tell me to wear red to school the next day, and I show up wearing blue. And in my perception, I feel like there was a joke and I just was not in on it. And I just felt off as a kid. You know, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. It just makes me a little neurotic, but it certainly played into that. And I just felt I just remember as a kid just crying and not wanting to go into kindergarten and in the first grade and second grade, just crying and just feeling full of fear and anxiety and restlessness and irritability and discontentedness. There was something wrong with me long before I picked up a drink. And I would rely on that. These times I'd come to AA going, I've got these other mental issues. I've got these other things going on that it's not alcoholism because alcohol is my solution. And at the age of 6 and 7 years old, I'm being taken to psychologists and psychiatrists because my mother has no idea what to do with me. And she doesn't know what to do with somebody who's throwing knives at her and punching her and kicking holes in the wall and kicking the crap out of his younger brother. And it wasn't that I didn't feel bad or I was a sociopath or it was I just didn't know how to react. And I would feel like this full ball of fear that I would just explode. And full of rage, and it would be on simple things. It was the selfishness and self-centeredness that I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I felt misunderstood, and my mother wasn't listening to me and giving me the love that I wanted. I grew up in a great family. You know, nothing wrong with my family. They're a little weird, but I am weird, you know, and it's what happens. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I grew up in the same family my brother did, and he turned out just fine, you know, but something was not right. And I believe to this point the problem was the psychologist and psychiatrist did not work. And it did not work for me because I suffered from alcoholism. I suffered from a spiritual malady. And they were trying to use psychiatry and medical science to treat a spiritual illness. And that's just my experience. And I'm not trying to knock it, but that was the problem. Because I would go and I would sit and we'd talk about my favorite subject for the next hour. At, you know, $170 an hour, we'd talk about me and how I wasn't getting what I wanted. And I would leave there pissed off, more pissed off than when I came in, because nothing seemed to be resolved. Because my mother was still in charge somehow, and I wasn't. And I just remember feeling like going to sleep at night, thinking, what's wrong with me? That I just, you know, there was Turns out I suffered from a spiritual malady, and I didn't understand that at the time, obviously. Today, looking back, I believed I suffered from the absence of God in my life. I suffered from extreme self-centeredness to the point where I would become violent because I don't know how to react to life on life's terms. And fast forward a couple of years, I'm 11, 12 years old, and I'll throw another temper tantrum. And I don't know the circumstances surrounding it. I don't know if I kicked a hole in the wall that night. I don't know if I hit my mother that night or my father. I have no idea. All I know is they said, "We had enough of you. We're leaving." And they left me at home. And out of curiosity, I went to the liquor cabinet. And I had taken sips off of my dad's beer before. And I don't know if I had a phenomenon of craving then, but I would take those sips and I would start to chug them. You know, and I don't know if it was because of the phenomenon of craving or because I was trying to be an adult or trying to get attention, but I had sips of beer before that. But this particular night, I just went out, and I had always been intrigued by alcohol. Just as a kid in restaurants, I would always be watching the bar and looking at the glasses and eating the maraschino cherries, and just there was something about booze that just intrigued me. And this one particular night, I was left home, and my father, I've never seen have more than a couple drinks. At a given time, my mother, the story goes that she was what the book would describe as a heavy drinker up until I was a couple years old, and the doctor told her she needed to stop drinking for health reasons, and she has not picked up a drink in 30 some years. You know, that's not my experience. My mother likes pills, but she's never picked up a drink again since. And there's alcoholism and other addictions and other craziness that run throughout my family, and I never thought I'd be like them. There was always going to be something different. My aunt is still a practicing alcoholic. Her husband died when he was 37 of an overdose. I had another cousin who was on something who jumped in front of a train. I have an uncle who shot himself who couldn't get this thing last year. You know, this is where I should be. I should be dead with them. And I need to remember the gift I've been given of Alcoholics Anonymous and just enough clarity to take some action. But on that particular night, there was a fully stocked, there's alcohol in the liquor cabinet. And said my mother wasn't drinking at this point and my father didn't drink much. And I grabbed a bottle of Wild Turkey. And the only reason I grabbed the bottle of Wild Turkey was because it had a cartoon character of a turkey on it. And I put it to my lips, and I put my head back, and I felt the booze go down, and I felt it come back up, and I felt it go back down again, and I felt magic. I felt the relief, and I finally felt like I could breathe. And I felt euphoria. And I didn't care about that I was going to get in trouble when my parents got home. I didn't care that I wasn't going to do my homework for the next day in class. I didn't care that the kids at school were going to make fun of me. I just didn't care, and I felt like I could breathe, and I finally felt comfortable in my own skin. I finally felt the way I wanted to feel in kindergarten and first grade. And if you're an alcoholic, you understand exactly what I'm talking about. And if you're not an alcoholic, you will never understand what I'm talking about. Alcohol allowed me to feel comfortable in my own skin and breathe. And I didn't run off to become a daily drinker at that point in time. But I put it in the back of my mind that this alcohol stuff works. When I feel bad, alcohol is going to make it okay. And that's the best connection I could have made at 11 or 12 years old. When I feel bad, alcohol is going to make it all better. And what happened was, you know, during my high school years, I would associate and find friends that parents were never home and had liquor cabinets. And it worked. And I would stay over their house a lot, and I would drink a lot, and I would drink without consequences. What was amazing was the more I drank, and the more frequently I should say I drank, the more my mother took notice that I was behaving myself more. The more it seemed like I didn't really need to see these doctors anymore. The more that I was drinking, the more that the doctor said, "I don't know what's going on, but he seems to be doing very well." The less I would drink during these periods, because I would go a couple months without drinking, the more likely it was that I was having these temper tantrums and that my mother felt the need to bring me back to the doctors going, "I don't understand, he was behaving so well and now he's acting like an ass again." And alcohol was my solution during these years. And also, you know, I began to understand that I was not drinking the way, I was not getting the same effect produced by alcohol that my friends were. Because we would talk about it and they would stop halfway through a beer and I couldn't understand that. And they couldn't understand why I just kept going. And, you know, I got into other substances, but the other substances didn't do for me what alcohol was doing. I remember one day being on the side of my friend's house, and we were smoking pot, and he was talking about how he'd like pot probably more than alcohol because he was catching a buzz, and I don't remember. Just as soon as he said he liked it as much, I just stopped thinking. I go, "You're thinking you're crazy," you know. And it was like really that. I was about 14 years old, and I realized at that moment in time that alcohol was doing something for me that it was not doing for him, because to him, pot and booze were doing the same thing. It was giving him a little buzz. For me, it was allowing me to breathe. It was allowing me to feel free. And during this time, I believe I was trying to fill a spiritual void inside my gut, the absence of God. And like I said, the book tells me I have a spiritual malady, and I believe that. And I believe to this day, unfortunately, on many days, that I live under the delusion that something from the outside is going to fix me on the inside. And that money, I chased money, property, and prestige, and her. And during my high school years, I chased money, property, prestige, and her. And what would happen was I would get her for a little bit, and then I'm ready for her. And once I've got her, I'm already thinking about her. And I do this to this day. And once I have that job, I'm already ready for my next job, and they don't treat me right. And once I get this award, well, why didn't I get two of these awards? And once I have this house, well, this house is not big enough. The problem is, for a guy like me, it is never, ever, ever going to be enough. Whatever it is that I think is going to fix me will make me happy for about 2 minutes. Because it's the absence of God, because I'm placing my dependence, my happiness on things, money, property, prestige. And what happens is I get restless, I get irritable, discontented enough, long enough. I know it takes away the big hurt. I know it takes away the uncomfortability, a drink. And I began in these high school years looking back, experimenting with that. And I joined every club and organization and made every friend I possibly could. And on the outside, by the time I graduated high school, I had this resume built up. And anybody looking at me from the outside should say, this is should be the happiest kid in the world. I'm senior class president. I have a host of friends. I don't like my friends, but I have a host of friends. I have a girlfriend. I don't like my girlfriend, but I have a girlfriend. Sort of senior class president. I'm in this club, that club. I'm first team All-State baseball in New Jersey. I've got all these things on paper that looks like I'm a success, yet I'm dying on the inside. I'm dying inside because it feels good enough. You know, I get this award for baseball, but now the pressure's on to perform that way again, and I got to live up to that. Or I've got this girlfriend that I don't feel worthy enough that I should have her, and I'm cheating on her, and I'm feeling horrible about it, and just going through the vicious cycle. And there's suicide attempts at this time. And I'm drinking sometimes, I'm not drinking sometimes. The bottom line is I'm not able to drink. I'm under my parents' roof, and I can't drink the way I want to drink. And I can't always feel the magic. I don't always feel like I can breathe. And what did happen is I moved out, and by the time I'm 18 years old, I'm a daily drinker. And I never planned on being a daily drinker. It really just happened. And I had crossed the line. And I couldn't tell you when I crossed it, but it was somewhere around the time I turned 18. And I just remember there was about a period of a year where every time I drank, it was euphoric, and there were no consequences. And I felt like I could breathe, and it was magic, and I could outdrink college students that I was with. I was able to outdrink with friends. I was able to be, I would be 5'8", you know, whatever, 5'10", whatever height I wanted to be, I was whatever height I wanted to be. And I could dance with the girls. I can get any girl I wanted. Everything went to plan, you know. At that point in the time, I was the director, you know, that talks about in the third step. And I could direct my way into whatever I wanted, whether real or not. I don't know if it really happened, but when I'm drunk, my perception changed and it became reality. And for about a year and a half, there were absolutely no consequences. But then alcohol turned on me. And I'm a daily drinker, and I don't want to be a daily drinker. And within a couple of months of being in college, I'm kicked off the baseball team because I'm not going to practice. And I start blaming people. It's really the coach. He doesn't like me. He's got it in for me. It had nothing to do with the coach. I never went to practice. I'm on academic probation because I'm not going to class. I have absolutely no friends at school. My parents aren't wanting to talk to me. I'm kicked out of a fraternity for drinking. The cops are starting to show up. I'm getting in bar fights in Georgetown, and I no longer can control. I can't control and enjoy my drinking anymore, and I can't predict what's going to happen when I take a few drinks. and I would set out to have a drink that day, and I would be, I'd have a case of beer. I don't know. Or I would start off with a glass of wine, which is sophisticated, at a nice dinner with a family, and by the end of it, I'm kicking holes in the wall, and I'm not getting the relief from alcohol. And sometimes I'm having two drinks and I'm on the floor, and some days I'm drinking all night, and I don't feel drunk. And I start making trips to the doctor for alcohol poisoning, and I had one physical where the doctor, by the time I'm 21, the doctor says, you need to quit drinking or you'll be dead in a couple of years. Your liver's already damaged. What I did was I ran Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went there hoping you guys would teach me how to control and enjoy my drinking. I wanted to go to AA to learn how to just drink on the weekends. I wasn't an alcoholic. That was the biggest problem. I didn't know what alcoholism was. But, you know, and I certainly was not interested in this God thing, because as far as I was concerned, God was for simple-minded folks who couldn't get themselves out of scrapes. And I was certainly smarter than you guys. And I left as quickly as I came. And over the next couple of years, I would show up when the heat was on, and it would always be the same excuse. I would never get a sponsor, and I just couldn't identify. I didn't want to identify. And the best I could do over the next couple of years was have a job where I was bartending, because I managed to graduate college and I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't get to work. And I'm deteriorating, and I'm 120, 25, 30 pounds on a good day. And I'm starting to hang out with people who I was not raised to hang out with, and do things that I was not raised to do, and causing torment in people's lives. And cops are showing up, and I'm getting out of trouble a lot of times. And for these couple of years, I'm able to, you know, control and enjoy the consequences. You know, I'm changing the friends that are, because the other friends are on my back. I'm justifying in my mind that my family is just evil. I mean, for God's sake, I went home and they changed the locks on me. Who would do that to their son? You know, it's their fault. They moved states and didn't even tell me. It's their fault. I don't really have a relationship with my family anymore. And I changed my major so I can, you know, get through school. You know, I start taking classes with the basketball team. I took a class on the Olympics and I got an A, and I took a class with, I was the only English-speaking student in there. It was like voice and diction or English 101. I don't remember what it was, but I got an A and it got my grade up. And I started basically changing the way I live to drink the way I need to drink, because I needed to protect my drinking. And if you said anything about my drinking, you were cut off from my life. And I would date girls who drank as much as I did, and hung out with guys that, you know, would sink to my level. Doing things that I was not raised to do. And I could, by the end, I couldn't even hold the bartending job. And there were times I quit drinking, and I remember there was this one period I had quit drinking and I'm bartending. And I lasted 23 days. I'm in a strip club dealing, and somebody offered me a drink, and it seemed like a good idea. I hadn't drank in 23 days. I'm fine now. And I'm back off to the races again. And I'm being taken to the hospital for alcohol-related things. And one time, I was working at a bar a block from GW Hospital, and I know I did not drink that day. And I don't know if I was having withdrawal or something, but I started having pains in my gut and couldn't breathe and throwing up. And they took me over to the hospital, and they kept me there for. At the end, I really don't remember how long I was there, but it was there at this point for about 2 or 3 days. And you know, when you first get to the hospital, they're paying a lot of attention to you. You know, they're concerned, and I like that because I like attention. I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I like when they're paying attention to me. And after a couple of days, when you're pretty stable, it turns out there are other sick people in the hospital, and they don't pay as much attention to you. And I wanted a newspaper, and somewhere along the lines, it went from the, you know, in my mind that I was no longer in the hospital, but I was at the Marriott, and I was getting really pissed off that they wouldn't bring me a newspaper. So I had an IV, and I had the gown on, but I put on my sweatpants, and I went out to the corner to get my newspaper. It seemed normal to me, and then it occurred to me, you know, the bar, restaurant, I could see it from the corner. They haven't fed me in a couple of days. This liquid diet's kind of lame. I think I could use a little bit of a burger or something. And I've never met a hamburger I didn't like. And I rolled one block into that bar and got myself a burger. And can't have a burger without anything to drink. And I had two beers. And I rolled back to the hospital and found myself back on a different floor. And they started figuring out what was wrong with me. But things like this would start happening, and I would laugh about it, and I would think it was funny, you know. There were really no consequences, because when things would happen, I would somehow talk my way out of it. I would get out of trouble somehow. You know, a couple of incidents where I would get, one incident where I got pulled over in D.C. I was going 75 in a 25, and I had been drinking, and I had other stuff on me, and the third cop who pulled over up was a friend of mine who had given me some stuff earlier that night. You know, I got let go. Get the hell out of here. I always seemed to get out of trouble. And getting out of trouble seemed to keep me on the streets longer because there were no real consequences. But what was going on is internally I'm getting more and more depressed. And there are days where I'm really just wishing it would end. I don't believe in God, but I'm praying to a God that I don't believe exists to just kill me in my sleep. I do not want to wake up because I can't face the world one more day. And I'm drinking mouthwash in the morning to keep the shakes off, because only an alcoholic would actually drink vodka in the morning, so I'm just drinking mouthwash. It's not a big deal. And there are days I'm just laying there going, this is the day that I'm going to go hang myself, realizing I don't have rope and that I'm too depressed to go to Home Depot to get rope. And I just remember that the last year of my drinking, I don't remember a sunny day. I know there were sunny days, but everything was gray. Everything was gray. And I looked gray. And I've seen pictures of me from that time, and I'm not even a yellow. I'm like a gray yellow. And I'm ready to die, and I'm wishing I would die, and God won't take my life. If there was a God, he would have taken me by now. And I don't know what exactly happened other than that a God I didn't believe in intervened. And one day I said a prayer to a God that I did not believe existed. That I basically said, I can't live this way anymore. I need help. God, please help me if you're there. And the only thing I could think of, the thought immediately came into my mind that maybe I should go back to AA. And it was really the last, I was out of options. And I think if I had some other options, I would have exhausted them before this one. Because that was really the last. How lame is it to be 23 years old and have to go to AA again? And at this point in time, I was living out in Northern Virginia, and I'm almost from outside New York City. I'm a city guy, and this past Dulles Airport, and it's all farm there, and I walk into a men's meeting and a bunch of rednecks, you know, and I'm going, oh God, this is what AA is. Like, I'm in hell. But for that moment, I didn't care. I felt so bad that if it meant I had to live that way, fine with me, as long as I don't have to live this way. And I'll tell you what, we get our opinions back. We get things back quickly, and I got my opinions back pretty damn quick. That was the first thing I got. About 4 days, I'm starting to feel good. And the sickest thing I've probably ever done in my life is I'm dying of alcoholism. I don't know what I have. I don't know what alcoholism is, but I'm dying of it. I'm thinking about homicide and suicide. I can't stop drinking. I'm dying of this thing, yet I'm going to tell you how to help me. And I began trying to interview, in my arrogance, begin interviewing sponsors, find a sponsor of high enough caliber quality to sponsor a guy like me. I would argue with people. I was basically an AA tick. I would come in the meeting late, leave early, make sure people called me on, because, you know, I had a cell phone, and there was, not everybody had a cell phone then, and I would just make sure my cell phone went off in the meeting to make sure you knew how important I was. I refused to do any service work, refused to drive anybody home. Why? Aren't there other people that do that? I don't do that sort of thing. Just fix me. I came back to AA to be fixed. Somehow you're going to fix me. And I didn't want to do anything around here, and I would just mock the slogans, and I would hear things like, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do. Well, what do you have, a couple of guns and a pickup truck? And I would judge you by your outsides, you know, and I couldn't. It's, again, the money, property, and prestige. That's what I was looking for when I came here. really the problem I was having is I had no job, I had no woman, and I was just totaled my car. I mean, that I want a car, money, I want some money, I want some property, prestige, and a woman, and I'll be out of here. And luckily, I didn't get any of those things for a while, thankfully. And I just remember that each day in sobriety that went by, I felt worse and worse and worse, and I watched other people get better. And then I got this sponsor guy, and I would argue with him, and I refused to believe in the God thing, and there was just so much that I just was not willing to do, and I thought I had it. And I would argue about the unmanageability. You know, by this point in time, I understood somehow that I couldn't drink. I understood, I knew I couldn't drink safely. I began to understand that I had this allergy. And it just means, allergy just means not like I'm allergic that like peanuts and I go into shock. It just means an abnormal reaction. I have an abnormal reaction. I understood that I had some sort of abnormal reaction to alcohol that other people didn't have. That when I take a drink, I have no idea what's going to happen. I might have the one drink. I might have 15 and be down in D.C. in 2 hours. And if I have a drink today, as I stand here today, if I had a drink tonight, I have no idea if I'll be at work tomorrow. I cannot predict that. You know, it blows my mind sometimes because you'll hear people in meetings saying, well, I know what will happen if I have a drink, and they'll predict, you know. I don't know. I might have a really good night. I might have a bad night, but I'm not willing to chance it. And at this point in time, I understood that I had this mental obsession because I'm stone cold sober and I still want to drink. After all the horror I've been through, I still want to drink. And I can look back at my history. I was given all these sufficient reasons to stop drinking. I didn't understand. My mom stopped drinking. Why can't I just stop drinking like she did? Yet it always took a drink again. And I remember this one time, I guess my head cleared up enough to realize that I was not drinking normal or something was going on during this first 6 months. And there was one particular time, my brother, he's the overachiever. And I'm trying to think, while I'm having trouble holding a job bartending, he's gone on, got a degree in biochemical engineering in 3 years, became a vet by the time he's 23, and he was bored at the time, so he decided to get a pilot's license. And I remember I'm out drinking with him one night, and now my brother drinks heavily at that time. I don't know if he doesn't drink that heavily anymore, but at this time he drank very heavily, and in fact, there were plenty of times he would outdrink me, and I couldn't understand it. And he was taking flying lessons, and I guess they're not supposed to be drinking before they fly, and I guess there's supposed to be an 8-hour difference or something to that effect. And I remember we're out in a bar, and we're going shot for shot, beer for beer, and it's a great night. And I guess he was flying at like 8 a.m., and he had to stop drinking by midnight. And he's halfway through his beer, and his alarm goes off on his watch, and he puts the beer down. I do not understand that. And that's the difference between my brother and myself, the non-alcoholic and me. Because I cannot leave a half a beer. I just can't. I was flying a couple of weeks ago, and where was I flying from? I was flying somewhere, and I liked to sleep on the plane, and right before I fell asleep, this woman ordered a glass of wine. I woke up like 2 hours later, and it's still half there. I wanted to yell at her. Like, you can't just leave it, to just finish it. And I don't understand that. And a lot of these, the brain cells were starting to come back, and I was able to realize stuff, but I couldn't get the unmanageability. I refused to surrender to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought somehow I was managing fine because I still had a couple of bucks in my pocket, and I was smarter than most of you. And I'm manageable. I have a degree in management. How could my life be unmanageable? Turns out I really didn't have that degree. I was a credit short. I thought I had that degree. That's how unmanageable my life was. And I didn't realize I was missing that credit until about 4 years later when I went to try to go to graduate school, and they informed me I didn't have all the necessary credits. But what happened was my life got worse and worse sober. Worse and worse sober. And I'm starting to think about suicide again. And how can my life be worse, sober? See, I'm not an alcoholic. And that's the unmanageability. It's the unmanageability that that goes between my ears when I'm not taking a drink. And thankfully, I had enough knowledge, if it's worth anything, that I couldn't drink safely. And I wound up listening to Clancy and Johnny. And they described alcoholism. And for whatever reason, I heard alcoholism described for the very first time. And I said, my God, that is exactly what I have. And I'm not saying other people didn't try to tell it or say it or whatever, but for whatever reason, something snapped on that day. And I got really scared really quickly, and I got hopeful really quickly. Because all this time I didn't have a solution. I couldn't buy into your solution. Because how could I buy into a solution that I don't believe is going to work for me? Because I don't know what I have. How could I find a solution to something I don't know what's wrong with me, if I don't know what's wrong with me? And I now knew what was wrong with me, and I now believed the solution. And I got busy really quickly, and I was more than happy to go through the steps. And, you know, I'll tell you what, I still had a problem with the God thing, but there was something keeping me sober. I believed it was you guys, and that was good enough to start. And you guys were a bunch of happy people. I don't understand how you were happy, but you're happy. That's going to work for me. And my just third step was I'm going to do exactly what you guys have done. And I did a thorough and fearless fourth step the best I could. My first one I did, my sponsor gave it back to me and said, good job taking everybody else's inventory, now go take your own. Because I saw that fourth column and I just couldn't get it. And, you know, I caught the part in the book right before the fourth step prayer that there are some people who are just spiritually sick. For my fourth column, I wrote, Mom, my part, Mom is spiritually sick. Dad's spiritually sick. Everybody was spiritually sick. And I just, the problem was I could not take responsibility for my own life. I don't know, I did the best I could with the steps. And I went through those steps. And I really went through the steps pretty much within the next, you know, that was in the first 6 months and the next couple of months. And by the time I'm, have 8 months sober, I'm carrying a message into detox. Some light bulb went off in my head. Something happened. And I tried to make amends. I mean, the first attempt I made to my mother, I really wasn't sorry. It was very mechanical. I didn't understand the true damage that I had done to the family relationship. And I had flown down to Florida and I read the script that I memorized that my sponsor gave me. And my mother informed me that I was making the amends improperly. And I proceeded to curse at her, you know, basically do exactly what I wasn't supposed to be, where I was there to make the amends for. And I had to fly back to Florida a couple months later and clean that up. And I've had to still continue to clean up stuff with my family because I still haven't always acted properly. But I have made those amends to my parents and have mended the relationship to the point that we talk on a regular basis. And I am allowed in their house. Now, I still am not allowed to have a key. They still haven't given me a key. But I'm allowed in their house. And sure, if I ask for a key at this point, they might give me one. And I've mended that relationship with my brother who wouldn't talk to me for years. And we talk semi-regularly, you know. And he's got a daughter I'm allowed to play with her unattended. You know, there's no concern. And the other amends that I've had to make that were uncomfortable that I didn't want to make, but it was just kind of explained, you know, you don't have to make them, but you may drink if you don't. Do whatever you want, but you may drink. And I got to a place at 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 months of sobriety where I did not want to drink anymore. That, I'll tell you what, the obsession of drink that I had for that first 6, 7 months was lifted when I started making those 9-step amends. As badly as I did, and as much harm as I caused afterwards, there was something different when I started putting an investment into my sobriety. When I started getting willing enough to clean up the crap and the messes that I've created in this world, and to take responsibility for the things I've done, the obsession of drink was lifted. And I slept through the night for the first time. And my sponsor talks about it, that, you know, all he really wanted when he got here was to sleep through the night. And I didn't know that's what I was looking for as well. And, you know, it wasn't just when I got here, you know, I was, it would have been a long time since I slept through the night, because I'd wake up, you know, at 3, 4 in the morning needing to drink. And that's not what I was talking about, that I was looking for. It was just to be able to put my head on the pillow at night and just not think about the things I'd done yesterday, the things I'd done a year ago, the things I hadn't done, where my life is going, who am I hurt, who's going to hurt me, who I have to look out for, and just having the rat cage go out of my mouth. You know, it was, I didn't need a TV to go to sleep. It was on. And I didn't understand that's what I was looking for when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 9 months sober and a couple of men's in, I put my head on the pillow and I slept. And I slept probably about 14 hours. And the desire to drink was lifted. And that was, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, I caught on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous and I started carrying messages to detox and I got my first sponsee and I got to take him through the steps. And I found God. I found God in his eyes when his eyes lit up, when he got this thing. I see God in the eyes of a newcomer when it goes from gray to color. I found God in the bottom of a coffee pot, you know, and I swore I would never believe in God, and I'm about 2 years sober, and I say the word God, and I don't believe that was me who said it. I have to, you know, check over. I wouldn't join in the, you know, I wouldn't join in the Lord's Prayer or the Serenity Prayer. I just, you know, just that's good for you. I just, but, you know, a couple things going on at 2 years sober. You know, at some point in time, I had to make the shift from belief in human power to a higher power, and I believed. I saw too many miracles, too much happen in AA, and too many people get well. Too many people who I thought were dead come alive, and I caught the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I got to, 4 years sober. I got to go to live in Southern California for about 4 years and go back to grad school somehow, and excelled in grad school because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't because, and I finished summa cum laude, not because I'm smarter than anybody, even though I'd like to tell you that I'm smarter than everybody, but I believe it's based upon what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. Because I, in, you know, the entire time I was there, I missed one day of class, and I was really, really sick. I showed up. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that. I would show up early for my classes and leave late. When I needed help, I would ask for help. These are just the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not something I came up with on my own. These were the instructions I felt I was missing as a kid that I didn't get. I felt like I had the instructions when I went to graduate school now, and I got that from AA. And what was amazing was I was able to help other people, other students who are, and this is competitive. It's all based on a curve, you know, and I had no problem helping other people. And I found out when I helped the other people, I learned the material better than anyway. But I only did that because I was taught that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got the opportunity afterwards to move back to Northern Virginia and the D.C. area. And, you know, in that couple of years, you know, I've gone, I guess I was 7 or 8 years sober then, you know, I've gone through the growing pains where, you know, bleeding deacon stage, which comes back about every 2 minutes. I prefer to be called the hemorrhaging rabbi, but... You know, and I've had relationships that I've destroyed based upon my selfishness and self-centeredness, based upon fear, based upon a lack of a faith in a higher power that people are going to take care of. And there's, you know, and I've watched people leave Alcoholics Anonymous who I never thought were going to leave, not understanding how can you walk away from this beautiful gift, this gift. And it's the grace of God that I'm here, and I believe that grace I'm given just to help is to help somebody else. That's that grace. A few years ago, I got diagnosed with, they found a lump in my throat and my thyroid, and, you know, and that was, I was scared, obviously, and I had called my sponsor at that time in California and started sniveling to him, and he cut me off during my snivels and said, did you or did you not make a decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understood him? I thought I did. And I realized maybe I hadn't, you know, and I'll tell you, and I had to get a biopsy the next day, or I had just gotten a biopsy or something, and he said, well, I got down on my knees and I said the third step prayer again, like I'd never said the third step prayer, and I'll tell you what, I completely forgot to call for the results, and it was, for the most part, generally negative. I mean, they're still, they got to watch it. But the point is, I'm fine. But the real point is, I said that prayer, and I turned it over to God, and I turned it over to the doctors, and for whatever reason, and there's worse things to have, and, you know, for whatever reason, that prayer worked, not because it made things fine, but because that prayer allowed me to get out of my own way. That's what prayer does for me. It doesn't, it's not about, I'll do this for you, if God, if you do this for me and make this all better. It's, God, you take care of it. And when I'm saying that prayer, I better follow that up with action, and that action is me get out of the way. And for whatever reason, I got out of the way long enough so I didn't go crazy and so I could be helpful to somebody else. Because that's what my life's about today. Book says, we're to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That's God's will for me. And that's it. And